So Roger, Mark, and Sandeep, in preparation for today, asked me to talk, if I remember correctly, I hope, in three major buckets. One is a position for adolescent sexual and reproductive health and rights post-ICPD. The second is, where are we in the post-2015 context, and specifically as it relates to young people? And then talk a bit about my role within FP 2020, which of course is a formal role, but it's not a paid staff role. I mean, I'm still hoping to represent the views of the larger community and of a really amazing working group of technical experts and professionals. So I'll talk a bit about where I think I see some opportunities for putting that perspective forward within FP 2020. So guiding on that sort of note of optimism and what we're seeing in terms of success, the situation for young people today, I mean, a couple of reflections that I hope ring true with those of you in the room. What I see consistently, and I think it's going to be key to getting over to really solving some of these intractable problems as it comes to young people and adolescents, is that we have a real fear of accepting reality. Reality that young people are having sex. Reality that young people are being married, that they're not finishing primary education always, but certainly not secondary education at equal rates. Getting out in front of what a young person's reality is and helping them influence the policy-making and decision-making process to solve those problems is key. And I realize that sounds quite common sense, and yet we see what's happening here domestically from a policy perspective, and we know that that's exacerbated at the global level in a lot of contexts. And in the prep session, even just a few minutes ago, Babatunde was talking about having been back in Nigeria with some colleagues and talking about how many of us now with grown children really took the time to talk to our daughters, our sons, our children about their sexual activity. We hope that they've made good decisions and are in a healthy, good spot, but that fear piece is one that we've got to get over and in front of if we ever hope to solve any of these other problems. I'm also sort of interested in thinking about the link that you've made around education and employment and young people's sexual and reproductive health, and that we're never going to achieve these economic gains, greater productivity, growth, social movements, unless we take care of people. And not just people, but women and girls, and specifically young people. So hearing at the Global Philanthropy Forum, where I was a couple of weeks ago, representatives from UNDP, from the World Bank, making this point time and time again, the investments in infrastructure and investments in schools only go so far if you haven't put people and their well-being at the center of what these decisions need to look like. Climate's a great example of that. You can talk mitigation until you're blue in the face and carbon emissions, but if you don't actually put women and their family, their health and well-being at the center of the climate debate and putting them as agents of change at those decision-making tables, I assure you, you will never solve the climate crisis. I also think that since Cairo, we've seen an increased focus on young people, but I think there's a lot of box checking. We build schools for young people, and then we don't put educated teachers in those schools. We put libraries up so that we can say we're meeting kids' needs, and then we don't put books in those libraries. I mean, and this is a fault of both not only the nonprofit space, but the donor space, who says, give me your quantitative measures, tell me how libraries you built. No, don't tell me how many libraries you built. Tell me how you're really serving kids' needs around literacy, because you've staffed those libraries and you've actually put good materials inside of them. And so I think there's a piece of the youth agenda, if you will, that's about a lot of box checking, and we need to get past that and really begin to unpack some of the data and some of the answers. And that goes also for our space around clinics. I mean, I'm delighted with the building of new clinics. I'm delighted when they're well stocked with supplies. I'm delighted when the healthcare workers have been well trained and really understand the rights and empowerment piece. But we don't have private spaces and confidential services for young people. Those clinics are not meeting the needs of the young people. So you can only check part of your box in that instance. Sort of a recent conversation and all this talk around new philanthropy and new investments and sort of watching the success of some of the big UN agreements since the mid-90s and what we're looking for moving forward. You hear a lot of investment from the private sector and venture capital saying, you know, we've really got to unlock human resources potential. And in fact, there was a venture capitalist from the Middle East who was talking about his big surprise in VC investing in the Middle East was women, which I took a little bit of issue with that being a surprise, but fair enough. What he said next, though, was really instructive. He said, it was such a big surprise, and then the big disappointment was when I was really interested in women's leadership of corporations and what I can invest in, there weren't really enough women who had made their way through secondary education in university and were part of the paid labor workforce that then were running businesses that I could invest in. And I was thinking the same thing about young people and their sexual and reproductive health. I mean, we know we have this enormous human resource potential there, but if we're not helping eradicate early forced and child marriage, and if we're not putting comprehensive sexuality sexuality education into the schools and into communities. We're not absolutely ensuring that girls are finishing secondary education so that they can go on to be a part of the labor workforce. We're not going to have them to invest in as human resource potential. So just to say that that venture capital sort of story around women really rang true for me within our space around sexual and reproductive health. And then I guess finally, as we learn from the last 2 decades and look forward, and this relates to that earpiece that I started on, it really is a decision, a conscious decision to be on a different trajectory. And unless we make the conscious decision to be on a different trajectory and to never, ever talk about young people as a problem, as a threat, as a vulnerability, the only way that young people would ever fit into any of those categories is if we haven't done the groundwork to allow them to realize their full potential. And I realize to some of you in the crowd that sounds sort of semantics and kind of a vocabulary lesson, but it's not. I mean, it really has to be about a complete reframing and repivoting of how we understand potential and what our responsibility is to unlock that potential for our future, not their future, our future. Showing up is 99% of it, as you well know, so showing up and really bringing a mindset of a different trajectory is sort of key. So moving, since we've talked a little bit about post-ICPD, I've been thinking about the post-2015. And I know many of you in the room are watching this process probably even more closely than PAI and IR. So let me put a couple of thoughts out there. We know that we're in the informals right now, and next week will be the last session of the open working group. And then we'll have a report that in September of this year, the Secretary General of the UN will have made a response to. And so over the course of the next year, September 2014, to September 2015, we'll have a whole series of global and regional consultations. So there's a lot of slides that are quite exciting about this process. I won't give that to you now. But to say that we haven't missed the boat, we've still got some time in front of us, but I think this next week is going to be an incredibly important opportunity for countries, member states around the world to show real leadership on this. PAI shares the perspective of a number of our colleagues in the sexual and reproductive health and rights field that there are some key places where we can advance the agenda for young people. I think the first one is that under the goal that is emerging around education, we need a specific target on comprehensive sexuality education. And it needs to be in exceedingly clear terms that that's what we're talking about. Even in communities where that is going to be a leap and a stretch, we know that we cannot see the next tranche of development happen without that. These are obviously a couple of examples, but I really wanted to sort of laser focus on today's theme. Under the gender goal, we need to be willing to talk again in exceedingly clear terms about the eradication of child early enforced marriage, full stop. No cultural excuses, no social excuses, it's over. And it has to be under the gender goal as something that the world community agrees to, and again, makes a commitment to unlocking the potential of those young women. And then under the health goal, we need a target around sexual and reproductive health, and I would say and rights. There are going to be some member states that really can only sign on to the reproductive rights piece, although I'm sure those of you in the room know how important sexual rights is, and particularly for young people, what diverse sexual orientation and gender identity means for their ability to realize their full educational and employment opportunities. So under that SR, HR, and or RR goal, we need some real focus on adolescents and youth. We need the target around sexual and reproductive health frame, but we've got to be willing to get specific around the needs of young people and adolescents. Ariel mentioned this earlier, so I just want to sort of bring it up that PAI and I think the larger community, you know, we do struggle with the universal health coverage umbrella, if you will. I think that it's the right thing to do in many respects, but I think we've got to be incredibly vigilant about where family planning and reproductive health falls under that. We know that some of those sort of benefits package can let some of the reproductive health and family planning services fall to the side. We knew also that adolescents aren't necessarily going to seek services if they feel like they're falling under their parents' larger insurance scheme. So back to the clinics with privacy and confidentiality. Now, all of that sounds, you know, like a complicated mess, but what it means for advocates is that if we're going to get behind a UHC mandate, we're going to have to be just incredibly vigilant and really paying attention to the specific needs of a piece of the larger health sector, which quite honestly is still running to catch up in some regards. So just to put that UHC out there, and happy to talk a little bit more about it. And then I'll close on FP 2020, and it's such an honor for me and for PAI. I have to say it's not just me. There's so many of my PAI colleagues who helped me perform strategically and professionally at the FP 2020 table. I think many of you are familiar with it. I think we're on exactly the two-year anniversary of the London Summit for Family Planning. And since then, an initiative was born that is called FP 2020. It's made up of a professional task team that's hosted by the United Nations Foundation and led by Valerie DeFilippo. And it has a number of working groups, and I am honored to co-lead with Siva Tanantaran from Aero, based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, honored to co-lead the Rights and Empowerment Working Group. And Roger Mark described what that work is. So let me talk a little bit about where I see gaps are more fun. So rather than sort of talk only about the success of FP 2020, let me talk a little bit about where some of the gaps might be, where it's a real opportunity for young people. One is that I think young people are a bit of a gap within FP 2020. We don't have young people playing leadership and real visible leadership roles within the structure that is FP 2020. I think the fact that it's called Family Planning 2020 can feel a little exclusionary to young people who either aren't planning a family right now or quite honestly might hope to never plan a family. So I think that's a gap, and again, semantics and framing, but that's how you bring people in a door, is for them to think that the door is made for them. So I think it's something that we as a community have to help get around. It's not doing as much on comprehensive sexuality education as we'd like it to do, and so I think that's an opportunity again for some of these related conversations to help that incredibly powerful and visible platform that FP 2020 occupies to move some of these conversations forward. And then I think also that it's focusing, as we all are, on both the supply side and the demand side of this equation. And as you all know, the demand side has some aspects to it that we don't always have figured out, the kind of qualitative and more nuanced aspects of an individual's experience with contraception. And right now, with the energy and enthusiasm and resources behind FP 2020, if this is not the time to finally unpack some of those questions and say, what is the reason that a program thrives and flourishes in one place and not in another? When we look at unmet need, why is it that some women have had and do have access to contraception, but discontinue use and don't really want to use it again? Do we understand discontinuation in all of its many forms? And if we don't, how are we ever going to make sure that young people who are using contraception for the first time actually never discontinue and use a different form of contraception throughout their reproductive and sexual lives? I think that there is, you know, within FP 2020, an incredible focus on domestic leadership. And I think that's a particular challenge for the issues around young people and adolescents. We want domestic leadership on these issues. We want the commitment of domestic resources. And then we want commitment from across government, not just your ministers of health, however important they are, but from your minister of employment and welfare, from your minister of finance, from your minister of the environment, to really understand the central role that young people play in all of these sectors, and that unless we ensure their access to contraception and their full sexual and reproductive health lives, that we won't really unlock the potential for domestic leadership on this issue. So that's sort of one. And I have to do a shout out. PAI is privately funded. We don't take government money. So whenever I do anything that touts USAID, I always do it, you know, from a real neutral space. But I will say that there's some really important stuff that's coming out just in The Lancet, authored by Ellen Starbird and her colleagues. And if you take the time to look at it, you'll see that they, with UNFPA, are pushing us to not only think about demand for family planning, not just as the percent of married women or in union women aged 15 to 49 who are using it, but to really revise the definition to incorporate all sexually active women of all reproductive ages as data and projections become available. So I bring this article up because it's fantastic. It's of course only one piece of the SRHR pie, but we welcome other people to come forward and help us to think through other ways that we can measure that across the board. But what an incredibly visible opportunity for USAID to take leadership on a program that they have had mastery over for decades, and to really help us think about expanding the need for data and understanding of this issue. We've got to put more money toward this, and we're not talking about dividing up the pie any further. There are more resources available. So I encourage everybody, donor or otherwise, to cast your vision upward. There are more resources in the world to get this work done, and let's not get territorial about where the money's coming from. Let's fight for more so that we've got more good resources to work with. with. We need to more thoughtfully invest in young people and adolescents. Talked earlier about no more box checking, you know, no more quick wins, no more low-hanging policy fruit that you don't have any plan to actually do implementation and execution of on the other side. And then definitely in more collaboration. We need everyone, and we've really got to start working across sectors. I have an unnamed partner in the U.S. government who, after a meeting with a couple of SRHR colleagues, said, well, I am really, really interested in what you guys are doing around sexual and reproductive health and young people, you know, but I'm really working on violence and an economic empowerment, so it sounds like we're not really working in the same spaces. And I said to myself, and then luckily a colleague said to her, but it is interrelated in an extraordinary way, and unless we start to really see that you're never going to tackle issues around gender-based violence or economic empowerment without getting at this, you're really missing the boat. And then the picture of success, you know, enough pictures of women, beautiful women in the developing world with six kids. How about a successful businesswoman in Nairobi who owns her own retail chain? How about a young Malawian graduate from university who's the first person in her family to finish school because her father helped her finish secondary education and gave her access to family planning? I mean, that's the picture of the women and girls that we want to help us advance the agenda for. So again, about framing and visuals, but really key to this debate. Thanks.